We have been talking about the whole period leading up to the return of Christ, the rapture, the period of tribulation, the battle of the campaign of Armageddon, the return of Christ, the judgments that came at the return of Christ, the judging of Israel, choosing out those who know Christ and those who don't, the judging of the nations, the same thing, and then the establishment of his kingdom. And so we're going to talk about the kingdom. Do you remember there's at least three ways of talking about the kingdom? We're either amillennial or postmillennial or premillennial. Amillennial means what? There is no kingdom, no literal kingdom. It's spiritual. Postmillennial means what? Christ comes after the kingdom is established. Premillennial, Christ comes before the kingdom is standing, before the kingdom is established, and he establishes it. I've been reading using Mark Hitchcock's book, The End, is one of the things I look at, and he mentioned hearing about a guy that was so thoroughgoing premillennial that when he went to a doctor and the doctor, asked him, open your mouth, say ah, he wouldn't. He said pre. And when it came time for breakfast, he wouldn't eat post toasties. He ate pre toasties. I'm sorry. But you notice I credit someone else is responsible for those. So let's talk about the kingdom. And again, he comes up with six reasons for being premillennial. I think it's helpfully summarized, and so I'll use his categories. First, premillennialism, that's Christ coming before the kingdom, Christ literally reigning on earth, best fulfills God's promises to Abraham and David. Premillennialism, second, it offers the clearest interpretation of resurrection in Revelation 24-6. Let me go back just to, so the promises today, we'll talk about these, I think, later on. But he promised Abraham, I'll bless the nations through you, I will give you this land. David, you'll be a king. The resurrection talks about in Revelation 20 that those who died in the tribulation are resurrected and rule with Christ on thrones. All millennials tend to say that that is spiritual resurrection. And that either is talking about heaven or it's talking about right now. Because if there is no kingdom, then they can't rise and reign. And so you have a problem with them kind of trying to make that a spiritual resurrection. It's not very satisfactory. Premillennialism is the earliest view. You go to the earliest church fathers, they all believed in a literal coming reign of Christ on earth. Four, it gives us the most natural reading of Revelation 21-6. And we'll talk about Revelation 21-6 in a little bit. But that's the famous passage that describes the kingdom. Matter of fact, maybe I'll go ahead and read it now. Then I saw an angel coming down from heaven, having the key to the bottomless pit and a great chain in his hand. He laid hold of the dragon, that serpent of old, who is the devil and Satan, and bound him for 1,000 years. He cast him into the bottomless pit and shut him up and set a seal on him so that he should deceive the nations no more till the 1,000 years were finished. But after those things he must be released for a little while. And I saw thrones and they that sat on them, and judgment was committed to them. Then I saw the souls of those who had been beheaded for their witness to Jesus and for the word of God, who had not worshipped the beast or his image, had not received the mark on their forehead or on their hands. And they lived and reigned with Christ for 1,000 years. So some would want to say that that's either talking about people now who are spiritually born again, or it's talking about going to heaven and the spirits that are there. It doesn't really fit the context. But the rest of the dead did not live again until the 1,000 years were finished. This is the first resurrection. Blessed and holy is he who has part in the first resurrection. Over such the second death has no power, but they shall be priests of God and of Christ and shall reign with him 1,000 years. So the most natural reading of that is there's coming a literal kingdom. Christ will return and establish a kingdom. Reason five he gives, fifth premillennialism, best explains Satan's current role and his future incarceration during the kingdom. See, amillennialists and postmillennialists tend to say the binding of Satan has already happened. It happened during the earthly ministry of Christ. And I also have a problem with that, because listen to some of these passages. The Bible says Satan is the ruler of this world. John 12:31, Jesus said, "Now is judgment of this world. Now the ruler of this world will be cast out." John 14:30, "I will no longer talk much with you, for the ruler of this world is coming, and he has nothing in me." He's called the God of this world in 2 Corinthians 4:4, and he blinds the minds of the unbelievers. That's not bound so he can't deceive. He is currently blinding, Paul says, after the ministry of Christ. So it's not during his lifetime. He's saying Satan is actively blinding those who are unbelievers. He's the commander of the powers. Ephesians 2:2, "In which you once walked according to the course of this world, according to the prince of the power of this air, the spirit who now works in the sons of disobedience." That doesn't sound like he's chained up. He's busily working now. 1 Peter 5, "Be sober, be vigilant, because your adversary the devil walks about like a roaring lion seeking whom he may devour." Now, when you typically, well, if you mention that to an amillennialist and say, "So what do you do with that passage?" They say, "Well, he's on a chain. It's a long chain." And literally, I mean, that's what you have to do with that. It's again, I read that, it's not satisfactory to me. He's currently scheming against unbelievers, 2 Corinthians 2:11. "Lest Satan should take advantage of us, for we are not ignorant of his devices." Well, if he's not deceiving, what are these schemes and plottings of his? "Put on the whole armor of God, that you will stand against the wiles of the devil." He's scheming. He's deceptive. He is deceiving. He's the accuser of the brethren. Currently, he's described as that. So, those are just some examples of the current active work of Satan. And so to say that he is currently bound and in prison and no longer able to deceive the nations, or as one of my favorite theologians, who's not a millennialist, says, described it, he says the fact that he can no longer deceive the nations, that refers to the undeceiving of the nations by the preaching of the gospel. And so this is one of my favorite theologians, and I kept thinking, boy, that you struck out on that one. so he can no longer deceive, that's kind of a stretch to say what that means. That's the preaching of the gospel, which is undeceiving. Those are two different ideas. And so the most natural reading is to just take it at face value for what it says. He is bound, he is kept from deceiving in the kingdom. He's not bound, he's not kept from deceiving. Now he's walking about like a roaring lion.
People, I think, are greatly deceived. How can they not see that today?
Yeah, I think the only reason you would say that, I think, is because you're coming at it with the understanding that this is the kingdom. But then you have a problem with, what do you do with a passage like that? If this is the kingdom, then Satan is bound. And so that's the struggle of that approach. Notice I said the one fellow who I listened to on this, one of my favorite theologians, this is a family difference. You can be wrong about this and be saved. Now, you don't get the best seats in heaven. No. But honestly, I would say this is not a gospel issue, because there are many amillennialists who believe completely in the atoning work of Christ, salvation by grace through faith alone. They believe completely in the inerrancy of Scripture. They're just wrong on how to interpret prophecy. Now, there are many unbelievers who are also amillennial, but anyway, to me, this is the most satisfactory way of reading the text. You come up with the premillennial approach. I appreciate there's one New Testament theologian, Thomas Schreiner, highly respected.
And a few years back, he had been studying in the scriptures. I don't know if he was working on the book of Revelation or what, but he was an amillennialist. And he just came out and said, the scriptures compel me. I've come to the place I'm now premillennial. He just, just digging into the scriptures, he came up as premillennial. Number six of Hitchcock's reasons, it maintains the consistent literal interpretation of scripture. In other words, it's, so you don't say, well, in prophecy we use a different set of tools. We interpret things all essentially the same and take this, and that includes literary devices and all that sort of thing. So, to help you on the exam, here's a mnemonic device he gives. Premillennial. Notice the alliteration. P, the promises of God. R, resurrection in Revelation 20. E, it's the earliest view. M, it's the most natural reading of Revelation 21-6. I, the imprisonment of Satan. And L, literal use of numbers in Revelation. So, if you are on the bus someday or a train and someone says, so tell me why you're premillennial. Just think through pre-mill, okay, and start rattling it off. When's the last time, though, you were on a bus and talking to someone over coffee or something and said, so what do you believe about the kingdom of Christ? Probably doesn't come up real often out there. Why the kingdom? So again, he's got some answers, and I'll add a little to that. He talks about it's the time to reward the faithful. In Revelation, the letters to the churches, constantly referring to the importance of being an overcomer. And it says, he who overcomes and keeps my works until the end, to him I will give power over the nations. That's something to look forward to. They will reign with Christ. Well, Revelation 20, verse 4, I saw the souls of those who had been beheaded for the witness of Jesus. They lived and reigned with Christ for 1,000 years. So the kingdom is when God can reward believers. Now, those are two good examples, but that he gives. It occurred to me that maybe a better one that I like to think of is in Luke, I think it's chapter 19, the example of the man who went away to get a kingdom. Remember that? Luke 19, verses 12 to 27. It says, therefore, a certain nobleman went into a far country to receive for himself a kingdom and to return. Jesus is talking to people in his day and say, I want to tell you about a story. Here's a nobleman who's going to go away, receive a kingdom, and return. So he's going to receive authority to reign, and he's going to return. I wonder what he's talking about. I mean, that's pretty compelling. That's what he's describing himself. So he called, in the story, he called 10 of his servants, delivered them 10 minas, and said to them, do business till I come. His citizens hated him and sent a delegation after him saying, we will not have this man to reign over us. And that kind of thing actually went on in the in that first century with dealing with Rome. They would, people of Israel complained about the governors they had, complained to Caesar. So he uses that, and the citizens were against this one coming back and ruling. So well, it was when he returned, having received the kingdom, all the complaints of those who didn't like him didn't matter. He then commanded these servants to whom he'd given money to be called to him that he might know how much each had gained by trading. So he said, I'm going to go away. I'm going to come back as a king. I'm giving you some investments. Show me you could be a good steward. Then came the first saying, Master, your mine has earned 10 minas. And he said to him, well done, good servant, because you were faithful in very little. You have authority over 10 cities. Well, the rest of the story sort of continues in that way. But here's the illustration he's saying. Those who were the more faithful in serving in the king's absence, their reward is when the king returns, they have greater responsibility. So another one that came in and said, I have 5 minas from your one. He says, okay, you get 5 cities to rule over. So the kingdom is a time where we can serve the Lord, and the reward is greater service, greater opportunity for service. So the kingdom is a time of rewarding God's people, the faithful ones. Let's see if there's another reason he mentions. To restore the creation. You know that familiar passage, Isaiah 11. The wolf shall lay down with the, shall dwell with the lamb. The leopard shall lie down with the young goat. The calf and the young lion and the fatling together. And a little child shall lead them. The cow and the bear shall graze. Their young ox, young ones shall lie down together. And the lion shall eat straw like an ox. Romans 8 says, creation itself will be delivered from bondage and corruption into glorious liberty. So when we look at the world around us, we think of the beauty of creation. Some of those beautiful wildlife, you know, remember some of you older one, who was the guy? Wild Kingdom, was it? I can't remember the...
Marlon Perkins
for some insurance agency or something, wasn't it? Mutual of Omaha. Okay. I can tell who the aged one here is. Ones are. Well, I mean, he is, you know, the incredible movies that they could get. Just, and of course, they're so much better even now. But some of those wildlife movies are kind of rough. You know, it's kind of beautiful when the leopard's chasing the deer, but then when it catches the deer, it's not, you know, lick them on the ear and catch and release. But in the kingdom, that's what they'll do. It'll be catch and release. They'll be playing and having fun. In other words, creation will be restored to its pre-curse way in most ways. I heard that, I think it was Hitchcock mentioned, I've seen it elsewhere too. P.T. Barnum, what's he known for?
Circus,
right. He was a showman, you know, and he apparently, one display he had was called the Happy Family. And he had like sheep and deer, or I think it was just sheep and goats, bunny rabbits, leopard, tiger, lion, all in the same display area, alive together. And it was really compelling. And so people once asked him, so how long is this exhibit going to, how long do you keep this exhibit on? And he said, as long as the sheep last. Once we run out of replacing sheep, in other words, it looks good. But that's not the way things are. In the kingdom, that fear of animals and animals' fear of us will be greatly lifted, wonderfully lifted. So why the kingdom? It restores creation to God's original intent. Why, again, to keep the promises to Abraham and David. To Abraham, he said, I'm going to make you a great nation. To David, he said, your house and your kingdom shall be established forever over you. Your throne shall be established forever. So Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, from Jacob to the line of Judah, from Judah to David, that's the royal line. He's a descendant of Abraham. And so Matthew, the New Testament begins. Jesus, he's a son of Abraham. He's a son of David. He's fulfilling the promises. Here's one picture of the royal grant that was made to Abraham. That's a type of covenant kings made back then. Sometimes they would establish a covenant. If you do this, I will do that. We'll call that the Susan Tree Vassal Treaty. But that's the Mosaic Covenant. The Abrahamic Covenant was more like a treaty form called a royal grant. A king, out of kindness and grace, no conditions attached, gives land to one of his servants or to someone. God gave this grant described, we'll get there in Genesis 15, to Abraham. And he describes these boundaries. Much bigger than they've ever held. So it's a promise yet to be fulfilled. One of the things that strikes me is he says it'll be from the river Egypt all the way over to the Euphrates, the great river. Notice this assumes that the river of Egypt is a smaller, very small river. You can kind of see it. Let me see if I can help you see what I'm thinking about. So here they're calling that the river Egypt. Now, when you think of a river in Egypt, what river do you think of? The Nile. And so I'm never quite sure, why is it we say the river of Egypt is this body here, this river here, instead of the river of Egypt, the Nile? Here's another suggestion. Here's someone that takes it maybe closer to what I would think. So you see, it's a pretty broad area. This is Israel's territory. to the Euphrates. This might go farther north than I would place it. I'm not entirely sure. But I've been inclined, I could be wrong, that it goes all the way to the Nile River, including the Sinai Peninsula. That, you know, it's, so he made a promise to Abraham. You'll be a great nation, and I'm going to give you this specific territory that they have never received. So again, I listened to an amillennialist sermon from a good guy, and he explained that is, what does that mean when he promises him the nations? That refers to the gospel going out. That the gospel will go to the nations, and that fulfills this promise. Again, I read that, it's just not satisfactory. That's not what the text, to me, is saying. It's saying he's going to have the property that belongs to those specific nations that are mentioned in Genesis 15. Why the kingdom? Now, notice my name is now, or Hitchcock's name is gone, and my name is not up there, but it's me that's talking. My laser point. Why, to accomplish the purpose of the creation of man. Man was created that someone in the image of God would rule over creation. Adam messed up. He failed. He fell. And so God's purpose in creating man has yet to be accomplished. He told man, I want you to subdue this. And so he was, you know, he'd be like his vice regent. Man messed up. And we have yet to see that accomplished. So Christ is going to come and rule and as Adam was supposed to. And man, in the image of God, enabled as one who was perfectly holy and also divine. What is the kingdom? It's Jesus ruling over the entire world from the capital in Jerusalem. In a nutshell, that's it. The word Messiah means anointed one. And that's a term that was used of kings in Israel. A king was anointed, oil poured over their head. A priest was anointed, oil poured over their head. And sometimes prophets were anointed, oil poured over their head. And to me, that always strikes me as a little messy. I kind of like our approach. Let me just give you a pretty crown, or just raise your hand, put your hand on a Bible, and repeat after me. No oil. But that pouring of oil, that's the word Mashiach, that's Messiah. They're Messiah. And so he is, if we say Jesus is the Christ, we're saying Jesus is the anointed one. He is to be the king. And so the amillennialist will say, well, that means he rules in our heart. If you're a believer, Christ rules in your heart. But the kingdom isn't doing so well. It's not an always cooperative populace, if he's talking about us. Christ will reign in perfection. Remember in Luke, when the angel spoke to Mary, what did he say? He, speaking of Jesus, he will be great. He will be called the Son of the Highest, and the Lord God will give him the throne of his father David. He's going to fulfill the promises to David. So his kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, dominion, all dominion will sure and obey him. So what is the kingdom? It's Christ reigning over the world, which hasn't happened yet. What is the kingdom? It's Satan is bound so he can no longer deceive. And we saw that in Revelation 20 already. He is bound so he cannot deceive. Right now, he is busily deceiving. That's why Paul would tell his people, I don't want you ignorant. Satan's a deceiver. Let me point out to you his strategies so you can be guarded. And the kingdom, have you ever heard the expression, put a lid on it? That's exactly what they do in the kingdom. Satan, put a lid on it. Or he tells the angel, put a lid on it. He is out of commission for the 1,000-year reign of Christ. That's another glory. What are some of the blessings? A righteous government. Do you ever listen to the news? If you do, you may want to take antidepressants or something. It's so discouraging. There is so much strife, so much conflict, isn't there? And one way or another, everyone's always accusing somebody in the government of being corrupt. And that's in our grand American country. And then there's other countries that there's wretched corruption as well. You know, I think, for example, in the Palestinian regions in Israel, like people like Yasser Arafat, you know, the people under him were, you know, terribly impoverished. And when he died, he had billions in his accounts, personal accounts. Maybe it's not fair for me to judge without a trial, but it sounds to me like good evidence of corruption. When Christ reigns, it'll be perfectly righteous government. I wonder if in the kingdom, maybe there won't be lines. Remember, I have to queue up, you think? Wouldn't now that would be glory. But anyway, it'll be a time of great peace. Again, right now, there's constantly concerns. What about Russia? What about China? What about this? What about that? Israel's constantly watching out for where are the next missiles coming from. Look at the strife in so many parts of South America and Africa and other regions. It'll be a time of complete peace. Like I said, it'll be a time of not just righteousness of government, but righteousness throughout the land. You ever grieve just to see the not only the unrighteousness of our own hearts, but the unrighteousness of society around us? It's grievous, isn't it? How often and how horribly sometimes it's expressed. It'll be a time of great joy. I put in there joy to the world. The Lord has come. We sing that at Christmas time, but it wasn't written to be a Christmas song. It's a song to celebrate the coming kingdom. Isaac Watts was a premillennialist, and so he wrote that song to talk about the joy when Christ comes to reign. Now, we can sing it at Christmas because that's like the first installment. He's come. He's coming back, so joy to the world. Now, when rocks and rills and everything will be calm and beautiful, he'll rule the world. And that's not happening in that way yet. But joy to the world when he does come. It'll be a time of great health. Remember, we've talked about that's the time when it says in Isaiah 65:20 that if you die at 100 years old, you'll be considered to have died young. And right now, you know, boy, if someone reaches 100, we're very impressed. And what is the oldest man right now? It would be something like 118 or something. In the millennium, if you die at 100, wow, so young. It's because the curse, but here's the point. That's not speaking about heaven. You don't die in heaven. So what that means is a time on earth when the curse is greatly lifted but not totally gone. There's still death. But it'll be greatly lifted. And it's also a time of great prosperity. Again, the curse being lifted. So the Isaiah 11 is there of the peace on earth. Well, here's a picture right of Isaiah 11, right? The wolf shall lie down, dwell with the lamb, the leopard down with the young goat, etc. And a little child shall lead them. Can you imagine looking out your door? Maybe you live in Alaska and your 4-year-old has a wolf by the mane and is leading it down the road. Panic. What do I do? Or you look out and your husband's out there. He's cleaning up a fish he's just caught, and a hungry-looking bear is coming up behind him. In the kingdom, there'd be no problem. The cow and the bear shall graze. The young ones lie together. The nursing child shall play by the cobra's hole. Not even afraid of terribly poisonous snakes. You know, a king cobra, one bite can kill an elephant. But you won't mind if your little 3-year-old is playing by the king cobra because it'll be different. The curse is lifted in Isaiah 11:6-9. We mentioned already an incredibly long life. No more shall an infant there live but a few days. Isn't that wonderful? No more stillbirths. No more infant death. Nor an old man who's not fulfilled his days. The child shall die 100 years old. So it'll be a time of great health, great long life. Jerusalem will be the capital of the world. So Jesus Christ will rule the world from Jerusalem. So let's talk briefly about Jerusalem and the kingdom. It says when Jesus Christ returns to the Mount of Olives, remember he left from the Mount of Olives, when he returns to the Mount of Olives, the Mount of Olives will split. And that day, Zechariah 14:4, his feet will stand on the Mount of Olives, which faces Jerusalem on the east. And the Mount of Olives shall be split in two from east to west, making a very large valley. Half the mountain shall move towards the north, half of it toward the south. And this is one of the things, one of the reasons I say it's so important for you to try and visit Israel. Because if you wait until the kingdom, it will look very different from when Jesus was there. So, you know, you'll have to just look at pictures to see what Mount of Olives. But right now, you can walk down the Mount of Olives, and it's the same mountain you walk down. No change. So it's going to be a dramatic split. And one of the big problems in the Middle East, right, is water. And that's going to be provided as well in that valley. In that day, living water shall flow from Jerusalem, half of them toward the eastern sea, half of them toward the western sea. The eastern sea is the Dead Sea. Now it's going to, right now there's an ongoing drought issues in Israel. The Sea of Galilee is way below normal. Matter of fact, they're trying and thinking of strategies. They have massive desalinization plants. They're developing strategies. Do we start pumping that stuff straight into the Dead Sea? Do we pump it into the Sea of Galilee? How do we keep this? Like the Dead Sea is really shrinking. The Sea of Galilee is way below normal. Will there be abundant water going east toward the Mediterranean Sea and south and west, east towards the Dead Sea, west toward the Mediterranean Sea from that Jerusalem? So here's a kind of, Israel's going to look different. There'll be some geographic changes. You can kind of see a layout of the land and also the layout of Jerusalem. But in particular, on this map of Israel, from that time, here you see, here's the region around Jerusalem and the temple. Right now, it's just a little spot. The whole Temple Mount is 35 acres. Here it's going to be huge. And you see that the tribes are all covering land over on this side as well as on both sides of the Jordan River. In biblical times and now, Israel was limited to west of the Jordan River. Now, of course, there was the two and a half, you know, the tribes up here to the north in Gilead, but that was kind of almost an exceptional thing. In the kingdom, there the tribes will spread out all over this. So geographically, politically, Israel's going to be different. A new temple will stand in Jerusalem. There are 9 chapters in the book of Ezekiel that talk about the temple, its dimensions, its construction, and the worship and sacrifices that happen in the temple. The sacrificial system will be very similar to the Mosaic system, but different. Similar, but different. What I mean by that is there will be the sacrifices of animals. There will be things like sin offerings. There will be a holy calendar, but it will be different. There will be priests also from the Levitical line during the kingdom, but limited to a limited line. Yes.
How can they do that if they can't curse anymore?
Well, God will be the one figuring that out. And actually, they say now that they can trace them. Those that are wanting to build the third temple are using genetic testing to determine who are legitimate priestly lineage. They're doing that now. So let me clarify. We talk about the coming third temple. The first temple built by, who built the first temple?
Solomon.
It was destroyed by the Babylonians on the 9th of Av in 586. It was rebuilt under, you know, Haggai's ministry, Zerubbabel, that time. It wasn't too exciting a temple. Herod came along and he remodeled it. So it was the, he was one of the first fixer-uppers. And so he did a major remodel and made it glorious. It was for his glory more than anything else. But that was still the second temple. First temple, Solomon. Second temple, Zerubbabel. And in Jewish history, we talk about first temple history and second temple. That's how they talk about their history. That temple was destroyed by what people? The Romans, AD 70, in the ninth of Av. Same day in the Jewish calendar, Tisha B'Av. That's a day of mourning and fasting for Jews ever since. And they noticed something. Twice Jerusalem and temple destroyed on the same day. Is God trying to tell us something? The Jewish people talk like that. There will in the tribulation period, there is a rebuilt temple. There are restored sacrifices. It's eventually taken over by the Antichrist. That's the third temple. But that's not the millennial temple. The millennial temple is on changed geography, much more expansive, very different in that sense. So that'll be at least the fourth temple that we're talking about here. And sacrifices will be offered. Now that bothers some. How can there be sacrifices in the kingdom? You know, Jesus put that to a stop. We read in the book of Hebrews, what's going on? Why are there sacrifices in the kingdom? I think the best way to think about that is in the Old Testament, the sacrifices look forward to the cross. Even though you offered a sin offering, it wasn't really the goat or the lamb you offered that paid for your sin. That was a symbol, death for death, but the payment was really made by Christ. You know, we use the illustration of a credit card. A credit card, you pay the bill, but it's going to come due. So the sacrifices of the Old Testament were looking forward to the payment of the cross. In the kingdom, the sacrifices are going to look back to the cross. They will have sin sacrifices, sin offerings, trespass offerings in the kingdom. But that'll be looking back as a memorial, kind of like the Lord's Supper does. It'll be a memorial. It'll be saying, this is a picture of what happened at the cross. So maybe that's a debit card, if the other one was a credit card. It's, you know, the payment's already been made, and this is reminding of that. It's an expression of that. But there will be sacrifices in the temple, in Jerusalem, in the kingdom.
I wonder if only the Jews will be participating in these temple sacrifices.
Well, only the Levites, the Levitical system will be providing the priests. Will the nations bring offerings? They will come and worship. I'd have to give some more thought to that. Because really, this is the center of world worship. And so this is where Israel fulfills its responsibility of being a kingdom of priests, where they are a nation of priests to the whole world. So Israel is kind of the center of God's program. But the nations will come up for the festivals, like the Festival of Booths, specifically mentioned. And if you don't come up, then God's judgment will come on your nation. So Gentiles will definitely be connected to this worship.
Will they have to be circumcised?
I don't know if it addresses that in Ezekiel as part of, you know, it's not the Mosaic Law. It's a different system. So who's going to be in the kingdom? Only believers enter. Unbelievers are perish at the end with the return of Christ. Children will be born in the kingdom. And not all of those will come to Christ. Those who survive the tribulation, those born will be mortal. Okay? So notice, here's the point. Those who live in the kingdom are mortals. They can get sick. They can die. And some will die. Isaiah 65:20. Some at 100 if they're guilty. Not all of them will come to faith. And that comes up because at the end of the kingdom, there's a massive rebellion of those who are unbelievers. And we'll address that probably next time. So, any questions? Yes.
On the map with the royal grant, Abraham.
Yes.
You said your or somebody you knew who's an amillennialist gave a reason what that meant.
This was a sermon I heard. What he was saying was that the promises of these lands, you are going to have the lands of the Hivites and the Archites and the whatevers. This land will be your land. I look at that, and God is promising him, you will have this specific territory as your territory. If you take that, but that's a literal kingdom. If you take it spiritually, the only way he could say it was, Abraham, through you, the gospel will go to all the nations. So that's the best he could do with his talk about the tribes.
He was considering that outline of the property that was promised as all the nations.
Yeah. And that's, because that's the best way he could understand that without saying that's referring to actually that specific land being given to Abraham. Let me just look at that real briefly with you. He said to Abram, "No, certainly your descendants will be strangers." Let's see. Did I already get there? In the land, in Egypt for 400 years and all. As for you, you shall go to your fathers in peace. You shall be buried at a good old age. But in the fourth generation, they shall return here. For the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet complete. That's referring to the son of the Canaanites. And so come to pass when the sun went down, let's see, to your descendants, I'm now looking at verse 18 of Genesis 15, to your descendants I have given this land from the river of Egypt to the great river, the river Euphrates, the Kenites, the Kenizzites, the Kadmonites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Rephaim, the Amorites, the Canaanites, and the Girgashites, and the Jebusites. These specific nations, their land I will give to you. Now, when I read that, what I understand is God's going to give the land, those territories, to Abram's descendants. What the amillennialist says is that's not literally true. The promise to Abraham is not about land, except in the sense of the broad influence of the gospel, that the gospel will go to the nations. Again, I listened, I appreciated the sermon and all that, but it wasn't satisfactory to me. It just didn't satisfy me that that's really what the text is saying. There may be others who have a better explanation for that, but that was just an example of a prominent amillennial preacher that was in Genesis 15. So that's where, by the way, a lot of people say, oh, it's all about the premillennialism. You're making such a fuss over one chapter in the book of Revelation. Not really. It's Genesis 12. It's Genesis 15. It's the promises to David and Samuel. It's all the Old Testament being fulfilled, as well as the promise to Mary by the angel. Your son is going to sit on the throne of David, his father. Yeah, so it's an allegory. I'll be honest, I am criticizing the amillennialist for not being literal enough. The amillennialist would criticize me for being too literalistic. And say, you're being too simplistic. And I've heard that. I've seen that said, what a simplistic, and look, they're going to take this literally. Yeah, I do. And so that really boils down to what's called hermeneutics, your philosophy interpretation. Okay? Good. We're approaching the end, by the way. We've gotten through the kingdom. What happens after that? And on our way to heaven.